Welcome back to Conversations with Consequences on EWTN Radio. I'm your hostess, Ashley McGuire.
And I'm Betsy Fentress.
And we are thrilled to have with us a guest who we have wanted to have on for quite some time. And he happens to be the headmaster of the Heights School in Maryland, which is where my two boys go, two of my boys. But beyond that, he's also become sort of a national expert and a seasoned educator on Catholic education, particularly for men. So joining us today is Alvaro De Vicente. Alvaro, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Ashley. Thank you for having me.
So part of what prompted us to want to have you on right now is this recent study that was released that was highlighted in the Financial Times and then broadcast more publicly by Jonathan Haidt, talking about a decline in conscientiousness in young adults. And this sort of comes as no surprise because the conversation of technology and attention and sort of a crisis of attention has been a big part of the national conversation, but you're really taking this head on as the headmaster of a school for boys. So tell us a little bit about what you've seen with attention in boys, conscientiousness, and some of the things that you're doing to combat it successfully.
Great. Yeah, the study is sobering and, you know, some could say could be depressing. I mean, not to be read in a rainy Monday morning because you might not get through the week. But I must say that I'm very optimistic as to what is happening with boys in our country and the potential. And the reason for this is that I see today more boys who are more virtuous and really committed to living a virtuous life than I have in the past. And I've been in education for about 40 years. And together with that, I see more parents who are very committed to also having a very good environment for their children in which they can grow to be those virtuous people. So I'm very optimistic. In terms of what to do or what we do here, I must say a couple preliminary comments. One is that sometimes we place boys' maturation in a timeline. And we're frustrated because they're not mature enough by the time that we think they should be mature enough. And I don't know where we get that timeline from, other than some vague memory of how we were, which is probably false, right? I remember one time being down in Florida and seeing this fellow walking around, and he was, you know, he was really, he looked to be in bad shape and aging much quicker than the days in his life should dictate. And he had a T-shirt that said, "The older I get, the better I was." And I thought often, like, well, that I think that happens to all of us, you know, that the older I get, the better I was. And I look back and I think, man, I never did those things. Man, at his age, I was, you know, doing all these great things. And frankly, maybe it is true in some cases, maybe it isn't. So we tend to put maturation in a timeline and then get frustrated because the boy is not mature enough. And sometimes we have to revisit, okay, is the timeline, you know, is it really realistic, right? Is it naturally realistic? And the second thought is that to say that a boy is mature or not mature is too vague a statement because maturation doesn't happen in every aspect of the boy at the same time, right? So I think what you encounter, especially with teenage boys, is that they may be very mature in one aspect and incredibly mature in another aspect, right? You know, the same boy who will do a wonderful thing around the house and be very helpful with his siblings and sensitive to mom's and dad's needs, then will do, you know, will be incredibly disorganized academically. And you wonder how, well, he's very mature in some ways and not so mature in other ways. You know, that's just the way he is. But with that in mind, I would say that I think a fundamental problem that we have in our society when we talk about forming boys is that we don't have a view of what man should be. You know, when we talk about forming, you talk about shaping, but you can only shape if you have a shaping mind that you're trying to attain. And culturally, nationally, I don't think we have that at this point. I don't think we have a universally agreed upon sense of this is what man ought to be. Although I think some descriptions of what a man ought to be resonate universally. For instance, here at the school, we say we're trying to educate the boy to be the man you would want your daughter to marry. That resonates because I think every parent, even though couldn't write a full description of what that means, emotionally knows, okay, I know that person when I see him, Right. So I think there are ways, to think about formation that way, but I think nationally we have a lot of work to do in trying to decide what shape should the boy look like when he's a man. I would say, two concerns or two challenges that educators and parents are dealing with in terms of the formation of the boys. And they both have to do with ways in which the boys are not allowed to live in reality. And the only way that a boy is going to become responsible is by dealing with reality, right? So if the boy does not live within reality and deal with reality, he's not going to be able to be responsible, right? And what are those two ways? Well, one is the much spoken about that anxious generation has spoke about, which is screens, kind of the virtual world. And I'm not surprised that boys are having a tough time relating. They're getting depressed, they're getting anxious, because their eyes are glued to the screens and they are not living in reality, and therefore they are getting chemically affected in their brains. That's one. The other one is overprotection on the part of the parents, that by overprotecting a boy, the boy is not allowed to deal with reality. And it could be physical overprotection. Don't go alone, don't walk down to the park. No, don't take the metro by yourself, right? It could be academic protection, like, no, you can't get a C, right? Fortunately, we don't really have this at the Heights because, I mean, as you know, Ashley, we have a great group of parents who are very supportive. But I mean, you hear horror stories of parents who, will complain as soon as their son gets a bad grade because how could he, right? As opposed to allowing the kid to deal with the fact that he got a bad grade, and now he has to do something about it. Now he has to fix it, right? And also, it over emotional protection, right? Overprotection emotionally. Boys are going to have to be allowed to really, get in a scuffle once in a while, and to deal with it, and not to have everything solved for them, and to learn how to make peace, and to learn how to not escalate conflict, and to know how to deal with rejection. The boy who gets cut from a team, to deal with that and not fight it. All those. So I think that's the second challenge, right? The virtual world, the screens one, and the overprotection that doesn't allow the boys to deal with reality.
So the things that you saw in that article in the Financial Times and that chart, do you feel like you confront all these at the Heights, or do you feel like you've kind of put something in place that has tempered these? And what would those kind of things be?
Great. I would say both. We do confront, those things at the Heights, and every school is going to do that in greater or lesser extent, right? So how to confront it? And this is part of the Substack on generosity that I was talking about. But I think there's going to be kind of four steps to look at, right? One is going to be, okay, first, the boy has to grow in self-mastery, right? Self-discipline. Think about, the old Greek analogy of a rider on a horse. And the rider is the will, the horse is the passions. What happens to most boys is that the passions are strong: hunger, anger, desire for play, right? Passions are strong. The will, the rider, is weak because of youth. The mistake that we make is to try to fix it, to try to impose self-mastery by beating down the horse, right? What we do is we go and we try to cripple the horse and beat it down because it's too powerful and it's taking the rider all over the place. The result of that is that you're going to have a man who's going to have a weak will, it's going to be a bad rider, and he's going to have a pathetic horse, right? That man is not going to be able to go anywhere, right? He's just going to slump along in life. So the approach that we're trying to have here is, no, wait a minute. The horse is good. The passions are good. The horse needs to be strong and fast and powerful. What we need to do is build up that rider, right? We have to build up the will. Ideally, you have a boy with very strong passions, but an even stronger will. That's the hope, right? That's the goal. How do you do that? I would say, well, really, the same way that you develop any muscle, you need will building exercises. And I talk about routines, a morning routine, right? I talk to the students about the five steps towards a good day, right? No snooze, no jump out of bed, make your bed, do a 5-10 minute workout, do some push-ups, some plank, some sit-ups, just get some blood flow and let your muscles wake up to the day. Take a shower. At some point, when you're a bit older and you want to man up, take a cold shower. And then get breakfast because you're a boy and you're burning a lot of calories and you need to feed the fuel, fuel the tank. So morning routine, afternoon routine. When you get back home from school, get changed, take a break, you know, go to the backyard, run around a little bit, get down to study at a particular time, right? Take a break after 45 minutes, study again, you know, get ready for dinner. Night routine, right? Shut down the screens 45 minutes, an hour before going to bed, you know, wind down, do some reading, talk to the family, you know, all these things, posture, you know, sit up, you know, not just because it's good manners, but because, you know, you got to build that discipline. Meals, yeah, eat a lot, but don't snack. It's okay to be hungry for an hour, hour and a half. You're not going to die. You'll survive like many have. You will, right? You know, patience. Don't say whatever you want to say whenever you want to say it. So self-mastery. The second step would be empathy, right? Because self-mastery means that you have the discipline, but the discipline is so that you can give what you have. Mm-hmm. And that's the empathy. Feeling the pain of another and wanting to do something about it. So I think for empathy, when we think about empathy for a boy, I would think about one is an intellectual problem. They have to see the need. Sometimes boys don't see it. You know, why don't you help so-and-so? Oh, I didn't. I just didn't notice. I didn't know they needed help, right? So intellectuals see the need. They have to feel the need. And that's the heart. And then they have to act to help it. And that's the will. So how to help a boy see the need? Maybe exposing them to great needs, right? Going to soup kitchen, going to a retirement community. Going to homeless areas, you know, bring food. So exposed to great need, but also to point out needs, to point out normal needs. Mm-hmm. Hey, your mom needs help. Why don't you help her bring stuff from the car? Hey, your little brother needs help. Why don't you, you know, get in some water? Like, point out the needs, right? Feeling for the needs. Frankly, I think that's on us to demonstrate it. I think we have to demonstrate how we feel other people's pains. You know, we have to be able to say things like, geez, I really feel bad for this person. Mm-hmm. Let's see if we can do something about it. Hey, so-and-so is sick. Let's bake some cookies and bring them over. Let's, you know, just demonstrate. And also asking the boys to pray. Hey, so-and-so is sick. Why don't you pray for them? You know, given, you know, there's something to do, but demonstrate this is what you do with need. And, you know, same thing for acting to help, right? Demonstrating how to help, encouraging in the instant, you know, help your brother put on his shoes, or maybe through later conversations. Hey, by the way, I noticed that, you know, yesterday, you know, your sister was pretty down and you just did not pay her any attention. Like, next time, you know, when she's down because she gets pouty, next time, you know, pay more attention to her. And then it's going to be the prudence. The third step is going to be the prudence of knowing how to help. And that's seeking the true good of another. And this mm-hmm. is an interesting one for boys, because I think is to help them see, okay, when you think about someone else, think about that person's physical well-being, intellectual well-being, moral well-being, and spiritual well-being. And you want to help each one of those four, you know, aspects. But if the physical is the lesser and the spiritual is the greater, do not sacrifice a greater for a lesser. That is, it's good that you help that person work out every day so he gets stronger. But don't take away study time because he needs to develop his brain. It's good that you're helping your friend get a good grade, but don't help him cheat, because he's becoming dishonest. It's great that you're helping your friend be very self-disciplined, but make sure he's not doing it just for himself, so right. that he's you know, cool and strong and so forth, right?
Does girls' school have a different set of these rubrics for bringing up young women?
You know, I would say to be frank, I don't know. You need to really talk to them to get a fair answer. But I think that these are,
I think they're applicable to everybody.
I think they're applicable. Yep. I mean, the actual application may be different, right? You know, how you're going to create your morning routine, that may be different. But the self-mastery, empathy, prudence, and self-confidence, I think those are applicable to boys mm-hmm. and girls equally. Mm-hmm.
And
that's the last one. Is the confidence is just the boy having the sense that he is a man of service, that he is a protector, you know, that vision is important to have, I think.
I think a lot of parents, especially at the end of summer, as the beginning of the school year is upon them, and in many parts of the country it already is, feel like they've kind of lost the battle with their kids. They feel, especially with technology, with routine, with order. What
Yes.
would be, one piece of advice that you would have for parents who are just wanting to get footing back on the right track at home?
Great. Great. I would say one is you've never lost the battle. Like you have not lost the battle. Like, you know, there's plenty of time. I would say apologize and change routines. Like, I think it's perfectly fine for a parent to go to his 14-year-old who has been getting up at noon for the last 3 months, who's been slouching around and who's been on the phone for 3 hours a day. It's okay for that parent to go to the boy and say, I have to apologize to you because I have allowed you to become really lazy. And that's not good for you. And shame on me for not taking you to task before. And now I'm not going to make your life miserable, but I'm going to coach you up to be a man of virtue. And we're going to make some changes. And here's a couple ideas. Here's a couple of ways we're going to start.
Wonderful. Well, Alvaro, we could talk for a full hour about these things. I know parents the country over would listen for an hour, but we're out of time. But before we go, the Heights, for those who aren't blessed to send their sons to the Heights, you have so many wonderful resources that are available to people. Can you tell our listeners about where they can find your Substack, your podcasts, and other resources that can help parents with boys?
Great, thank you for that. So two main resources. One in the Heights website, so heights.edu. There is a section called the Forum, and the Forum has hundreds of podcasts and videos and essays and articles on education. Some of them are intended for other educators, other schools. Many are intended for parents. And those are freely available for anybody to look into them. And you can subscribe to the forum so you get all the new material automatically into your inbox. So that's one. And the other one is I have a separate Substack and is Alvaro De Vicente, Men in the Making. And unfortunately, I'm not a super technical guy, but I think that hopefully that's enough to find it. And I just put out every couple of weeks, I put out a sort of an article on education matters, which, you know, like the one that prompted this conversation today.
Well, I strongly encourage our listeners to avail themselves of those resources. I can personally attest they work. I have two boys who wake up and make their beds every morning.
Oh, great.
So it does, these things do work. But we're so grateful for your time, Alvaro, and for all that you're doing to better the culture for men and for families. So thank you for joining us today, Alvaro.
Great. Thank you, Ashley. Thank you, Betsy, for having me.
Welcome back to Conversations with Consequences, where I am once again joined by our resident chaplain, Monsignor Roger Landry. And we have a great feast to talk about today, Father, Monsignor, the Feast of the Assumption, Friday, August 15th. Tell us about this feast and why did it take so long to be declared just in November of 1950?
Well, there was always a tradition that Our Lady was assumed body and soul into heaven. Mm-hmm. The controversy was whether she actually died before she was assumed, or whether she just fell asleep. Everybody thought that she had died and then more or less raised from the dead and brought up body and soul into heaven. But St. Alphonse Liguori in the 1700s started to ask the question as to, well, death is a consequence of sin, and Mary had never sinned, so how could she have died, which would have been an effect of sin, and so that therefore she would have only kind of fallen asleep and looked as if she were dead, but never having deceased. Well, I love St. Alphonse Liguori. He's the doctor of moral theology. He's much holier than I am. I could speak about St. Alphonse Liguori forever and all the books he wrote with migraine headaches and how he never wasted a second. But on this score, come on, St. Alphonsus. Jesus, of course, never sinned, and we know he died on Good Friday, so it's possible for someone who was sinless to die. And the tradition of Mary's death, I think, is a little stronger, which was the way it was looked at over the course of the centuries. But she was assumed body and soul at the end of her earthly life in 1950. Pius XII said at the end of her earthly life, not taking a position on whether she died or just fell asleep, she was assumed body and soul into heaven. There, that had always been the church's pious understanding. We know as soon as we started to pray the rosary, we were always pondering Mary's assumption into heaven. There are some oblique references, for example, in sacred scripture, particularly Revelations 12, about this woman being assumed with a crown of 12 stars and with the moon under her feet, etc. That's not a slam dunk proof of the assumption, but the church has always looked at it as a symbolic reference to Mary's assumption and coronation, which we'll have a chance to talk about next week. So it was only in 1950 when the church dogmatically proclaimed it, lest anybody have any doubt. There had been lots of requests from bishops' conferences all across the world to Pope Pius XII. As we were coming up to the 100th anniversary of the solemn dogmatic declaration of Mary's Immaculate Conception, that maybe we could do the same for Mary's Assumption. And so Pope Pius XII did, confirming the faith of the church, which has lasted over the course of centuries. What I really think is special for us to do this year is when we celebrate a holy year, like we're now celebrating the Jubilee of Hope, that Holy Year is supposed to influence everything we do. It's supposed to give a little bit of flavor, a new angle by which we can look at the truths of our faith. And the Assumption really is one of the great examples of Christian hope. When you look at the Catechism, paragraph 1817, it talks about that hope is the theological virtue, the moral muscle that helps us to relate to God. That's what Theologos means. It's how God speaks to us and we speak back. It's the moral muscle that helps us to relate to God and place our hope in the kingdom of God, which means not just in this world, but forever, trusting in Christ's promises and relying not on our own strength, but on the power of the Holy Spirit. And so when we think of Mary's Assumption, we're thinking about the great hope that we Christians have to be able to live fully among the communion of saints within the communion who was Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, the Blessed Trinity in heaven. Mary shows us the destiny of human life. When we die, we're not going to be assumed body and soul immediately into heaven. We hope we're going to be positively judged at our particular judgment, and that our souls will rest in God, awaiting the general resurrection when our body is restored. But Mary shows us not only the destiny of the human soul, but how our human bodies are meant to come back in communion with our human souls to be able to be in God's presence forever. And so the Assumption confirms our hope, and hopefully is like that anchor that the letter to the Hebrews talks about, that Pope Francis uses the image for this Jubilee. Hope is the anchor, is the sign of hope, which we cast not into the depth of the sea, but we cast beyond the veil, the letter of the Hebrews says, beyond the clouds to ground us in God. When Mary was assumed, she basically made that anchor in heaven even firmer for us who receive her help to follow the blessed fruit of her womb all the way to the Father's eternal embrace.
That's really beautiful. So, when you're preparing for a feast, a Marian feast, are there any particular practices or prayers that you like to pray leading up to that feast?
So, for example, for the Assumption, I love to pray the traditional Latin hymns that talk about Mary in heaven, especially the Ave Regina Caelorum, the Hail Queen of Heaven. I just think it expresses the sentiments of Christian people deeply in love with the mother God the Father chose for his son, and that son, Jesus, chose for us from the cross when he said, "Behold your mother and behold your son." I've always benefited a lot from asking Jesus to teach me to love his mother more, and asking Saint Joseph to help me to love Our Lady even more profoundly, as both of them really deeply loved her. When we look at Mary, we look at the greatest disciple ever of Jesus. And so she has so much to teach us about how to follow her son. She's the great apostle who immediately, as soon as she had conceived him, went with haste to bring him to Elizabeth, Zechariah, and John the Baptist. And if we believe in the Marian apparitions like Guadalupe and Lourdes and Fatima, which we don't have to as Catholics, but common sense shows us that this isn't being made up, that Mary's constantly trying to bring us to her son and bring her son to us. So she's a great apostle. She's a great mother who tries to raise us to imitate the virtues of her only begotten son, our Lord Jesus. And she's also an extraordinary intercessor, praying for us before Jesus, just like she did for that couple in Cana of Galilee before they even knew they had a crisis of a lack of wine for an 8-day wedding reception on their hands. And she continues to intercede for us. I love that apparition to St. Catherine Labouré in the Miraculous Medal, in which St. Catherine asked Our Lady, like, why do you have rings on all your fingers? And some of them are bright like the sun, and some are dull and dark. She said, the bright rings are the prayers I've made for people on earth, and they've received those graces. The dull rings are the graces I've interceded for that they're indifferent to, or they just haven't collaborated with. And so Mary's constantly interceding for us. And the Feast of the Assumption is an opportunity for us to make her fingers glow.
That is a great visual. And thank you so much, Monsignor. And we'll look forward to putting some of these ideas into practice.
Happy Solemnity of the Assumption, Betsy.
Welcome to Conversations with Consequences. I'm your host, Betsy Fentress, alongside my good friend and TCA colleague, Lee Sneed. And we have an exclusive today, the first interview with Lee on her just-announced book, Infertile But Fruitful. It's out next year from Sophia Institute Press and tells the story of a Catholic couple, Lee and Carter Sneed, who married young and then spent 2 decades hoping, trying, and failing to achieve pregnancy. And we're so grateful to have you here with us, Lee. And by the way, there's a lot of happy endings to this story. Thank you for joining the show. We've missed you.
Oh, I'm so happy to be back in the swing of things.
Well, you've just had a milestone in your life, which means you've turned in your book to Sophia Institute Press. And now, finally, we can talk to you about it.
Yeah.
So it covers so poignantly how carrying the cross of infertility brings challenges to faith, marriage, and sense of self, but also how this particular cross can ultimately strengthen all of these and fortify a life that bears many holy fruits. Those are your words.
Mm-hmm.
So let's go start at the beginning of how you decided to write this book, and then we'll get into the contents. So taking on a book is a big undertaking. It requires a lot of self-discipline. And you decided to go on this path because of what?
It was a lot of it was because of the response I'd gotten to a couple infertility essays I'd written for the Register. But before that, you know, even when I was sort of in the mix, like in my 20s, you know, trying to get pregnant, I've always liked to write. And I was in graduate school at the time, but I was thinking about a novel called Unexplained, about the story of a couple, you know, who had infertility. And that was sort of, you know, it was a big time for chick lit in those days. Bridget
you know
Jones,
what? You
Diary,
could still,
things like
you
that.
You could still do that, Lee.
I could still do that. But I, you know, I think, I can't remember exactly, but I think around that time there was, I can't actually remember how the story ended. But again, at that point, I still hoped that my story was going to end in a pregnancy at some point. I think once I really got into the trenches and, you know, doing this for years and years. And then also becoming a mother at the same time, because we decided to pursue adoption simultaneous with pursuing pregnancy. You know, I kind of lost that idea. And then I wrote about a lot of other things over the years. And then these opportunities came up. I think maybe it was Mother's Day, National Infertility Week, something. And so it was timely. And I thought, okay, now's the time. And the number of emails, DMs, people who reached out, husbands, wives, priests, it was really something. It was people I didn't know people. I did know that I didn't realize we're suffering. And it was just like, hey, this really hit. And then with the encouragement of some influential people in my life, it was like, this is your book. And so that's what it was. And I think every step of the way is confirmed that this was a good decision and that the time is right to talk about this. And I'm in a good place to talk about it too, because I'm 50 now. I'm not trying to get pregnant anymore. I'm not sad, but you stay infertile. I'm still infertile. And that is something that still stings a little bit every once in a while.
So that's interesting that you brought up that you heard from husbands. And did you and your husband, Carter, have to sit down and have a talk before you wrote this and say, here are the personal details of our lives that are either too painful or too private to share. Here's what's off the table. Here's what's on the table. Or was it more that you just wrote the book and then pulled back anything that once the two of you read it, thought, this doesn't seem right?
A little bit of both, I think. I think there were some things that were just sort of understood between us that, I mean, there's not much I don't include, really. I do really include a lot of things. And again, I think that's because it's a part of my life that's over, that sort of quest for pregnancy. But I know there was one point when he was reading a chapter and he's like, whoa, this is really personal, huh? I was like, yeah. And he's like, all right. And but at the same time, he's actually working on a book of his own, so he didn't have a lot of time to spend going over my pages. But yeah, I think there is something. I mean, even actually after I just had this Substack post, two men who are friends of ours, who again, I didn't think about them as an audience or any, or that they would even, just read it at all. But they both reached out to us, saying that it moved them, even though, I was writing from a female perspective.
So IVF seems to be in the news almost every day now, first with the Alabama case, and now with these designer baby firms that are allowing you to do this deep dive into the DNA of embryos created through IVF. What is your response to all of that? And how do you talk to people without shaming them in their ignorance about what is really involved in the destruction of life through the IVF process?
Well, when these stories came out, I don't forget which one it was, maybe the New York Times, and the woman who founded this gene screening.
Yeah, the Rouse Douthat that interview.
She, said something, sex is for fun, this is orchid, right? It's for making babies. And all I could think of was just from a personal perspective is for me, all I wanted to do was to, have sex like a normal person and get babies. And the idea that you would choose, because I get the impression a lot of her target customers are maybe not even infertile, but they just want the control over, the makeup and
Yes, I got that
the
sense too.
inheritable illnesses, et cetera. And but the, so the idea that you would choose to separate procreation from the, unitive, like on purpose, willingly, voluntarily, was just crazy to me. And I think that too, just I think brings home that just that sort of innate wisdom that NAPRO technology and other natural restorative medicine practices, the way they appeal to us is because, yes, we want to restore a woman to health. And this is, and it's natural that children should come from the loving embrace of two married, devoted people. And so to make like it's not a big deal, what's happening with the push for designer babies is, I mean, it's really foreign to me. I don't know how quite to make sense of it other than we're so lucky with our church teachings and the rich tradition in the church and all the different people we have who are writing about it and talking about it, because it really, we understand what it means to be human. What it means to be, sons and daughters of God the Creator, and how that plays out in how we build our families. I think that, and well, talking to people is hard. I had, thought maybe I could write a book that was marketed more towards, anyone suffering with infertility, but then I realized that. In the same way that when I would come across, when I was reading books about infertility, It was often about IVF. That's what the people in the stories did. And so I was just like, oh, this isn't for me. I imagine people would feel the same way, and especially they might feel defensive. And it's so common now that often people, they either have child or a grandchild that was conceived through IVF, or they know someone else's daughter who did it. And it's just it's hard to explain that we love them, we love the child, but this is a practice that we don't agree with for lots of reasons.
I think that conversation is a hard one to have because the child is there, in our midst. In abortion, I feel like a lot of people, they do know that abortion is wrong and they know that abortion is taking of a life. But here's another reproductive issue that goes against church teaching that results in a life. It's kind of the opposite of
Yes,
the
I've heard people
outcome.
even say that IVF is pro-life.
Right.
Yeah.
But I don't think that they want to acknowledge the destruction that is
True.
inherent in the selection, of the embryos. And is
No.
that something from day one that you really understood in your marriage, or did you grow into the church's teachings on the unitive and procreative nature of married
I
life?
think, yeah, I think we knew. Well, Carter was the general counsel for the President's Council on Bioethics, and so he was actually writing the first year we were trying to get pregnant. He was writing the government report, Reproduction and Responsibility. So with every, they say like if you don't conceive within 12 months, right, then it's time to see a doctor. And it just seemed like clockwork that every month that ticked by that first year where we still weren't pregnant, Carter was also researching and writing about some new thing that could be wrong. So we sort of knew all these different things. And I think, yeah, I think we were lucky enough to have been informed about the church teaching on IVF and even other, writers, philosophers who disagreed with the practice, even from a non-Catholic perspective, before it was something that affected us. And that's not to say that we weren't, tempted seems so active in a sense, but you do have those little fantasies of, we could just do it once. We could just do two embryos. We could do a natural cycle IVF, which some people do. But it's, but you shouldn't, and you don't really want to. That's not really how you want to have a baby. But when you're just there, and we made the mistake of going to a mainstream doctor, who didn't much care about our preferences, even though we restated them time after time. He sort of mocked us for our religious beliefs, said that he had been raised Catholic, and somehow that was supposed to make it better. And even got the last day we were in his office, he actually screamed at us, "I'm making life back there. I'm not destroying it." And we're just like, "Oh man, we got to get out of here." And we never went back, thank goodness. But it really is. I mean, would you just your arms are empty and you just want a baby. And you've been trying the old-fashioned way, or even like a boosted up with drugs old-fashioned way, and it's not working.
And so, how did that spiritually affect you, Lee, and psychologically? And do you deal with that in the book of this that, I'm not a lesser woman because this particular part of my anatomy isn't working the way I want it to.
Well, I mean, I definitely had those moments. You feel, unattractive, less feminine. I actually had made up it part joke, part just infertility related craziness, this fictional character named Fertile Myrtle. And she was like a beautiful, elegant, devoutly Catholic supermodel who was very, very fertile. And I was pretty sure she was coming to steal my husband from me. So Fertile Myrtle, she's in the book. So I mean, There's definitely a lot of that, especially as the years went on, and it seemed like everybody was getting pregnant because, we were young, we were in our 20s, and
Sure.
that was the time of life it was. And it's just like, why not me? Like, what did I do? What didn't I do? Like, what is it about us that we can't do this? It's a lot of horrible feelings you have. And I think, your faith can keep you grounded. I don't know whether it's both of us or just me. I think it is both of us that we, due to different, divorced parents, different things in life, we always just sort of accepted sort of suffering as part and parcel of the human experience. And, but at the same time, you never think that a cross like this is going to be yours to carry. And picking it up and carrying it is so hard because you just want to be sort of in denial until finally you get that positive pregnancy test one morning. But when you decide to kind of, I hate this phrase, but lean in,
Surrender is probably the more
surrender. That's the one I'm looking
Catholic
for,
word.
Betsy. Thank you.
Yeah.
Once you sort of do that and you think, okay, if it comes, it comes. If it doesn't, it doesn't. That's a real gift, but it does take some heavy lifting and a lot of prayers. And I think because of the nature of infertility, it's so personal. I mean, it's your love life, right? Sort of. And the it's hard to ask for people's prayers, but man, I feel like it's the most important thing you can do. And things will be revealed, and Providence has her way with you. And but it's a lot easier being buoyed up by the prayers and concerns of, the love of people around you. And when you don't give them a chance to support you or pray for you or love you like that, it's you're denying yourself, the balm that you really need in those moments.
You know, it's interesting, two of the biggest stories in the Bible, the birth of John the Baptist and the birth of Isaac, are both stories about sort of the heartbrokenness of women who were unable to have children. Were there any stories, either in literature, or passages in scripture or just contemporary books, that you would turn to where you just thought, I want to read this and drown my sorrows or feel solidarity with this particular book?
I have to say, just like the two Bible stories, so many of these stories always end in pregnancy. That's the, that's so that's wasn't what I wanted to be reading right then.
Yeah, I
And
okay.
even the nonfiction books on infertility almost always ended up in pregnancy. Or they were, it was somebody who was, in their late 30s, early 40s when they got married, not 23 like I was. And, that's a different kind of thing because you maybe have a inkling that this might be a little harder for me than it would have been, say, 10 years ago or something. But, at 23, 24, 25, 26, 27, you can't imagine it happening to you. And so I think, I can't. I have over the years, and actually I give a list in my book of some television episodes and some movies that are pretty great that really I think treat the issue of infertility well. I wish I'd had something great that I knew about or, because I that would been a good way to kind of lock in and be miserable while being entertained,
You had told me in another conversation that we had that Leon Cass's book was kind of influential for you. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because he comes from a Jewish tradition, not a Catholic tradition, and he's looking at all of these bioethical issues. So, from some of the, because we're part of the Judeo-Christian tradition, but tell us what that he wrote that resonated with you.
Well, there were a couple of things. I mean, he was really, his work was really instrumental in me going a PhD program in philosophy because I had wanted to take a deeper study of Aristotle and Descartes and apply that to medical ethics. And so when I read his works, that's the angle I want to take because people get all kinds of degrees and do bioethics or medical ethics, but philosophy was the way I wanted to approach it. And so reading that book, but I the two things, and I was actually thinking about this a couple questions ago. Leon Cass talks about the wisdom of repugnance. And it's sort of like how you don't have to explain why incest is wrong. Like you just know it's wrong. That sort of like that sort of innate, like you hear about it and you say, yuck, you know? And
I
there's a
mean,
wisdom in that. There's something like that's that we just know that that's
shouldn't
not good.
abortion evoke the same thing?
Yes, and IVF for me. Like that's n and with
Surrogacy.
I it, surrogacy, so many things. And with that, his discussion about IVF and some other, maybe probably mostly IVF, I guess, is about it invites a third person, I mean, often probably m way more than just a third person into the bedroom. And like we talked about before, like all I wanted was to make a baby in my bedroom. And I think that's the wisdom of repugnance too, like the idea of it being clinical and hyper-medicalized and then obviously also maybe eugenic or all these other things that go along with it now that the more testing becomes more sophisticated. Those two things, the wisdom of repugnance and the idea that you're inviting someone into the bedroom.
That's a really powerful way to look at it. And I know that reliving all of the things that we're talking about was really hard. And in your recent Substack piece, Why I Wrote a Book on Infertility, you wrote, "I was not tearing up because my prose was just so beautiful. Hardly. I, like many writers, can often find my own words, well, cringy. It brought me to tears because the intense pain of infertility, feeling betrayed by your own body and trying to realize your vocation and most desired dream is like almost nothing else. But I would sometimes cry tears of joy for the fruitfulness and blessing that was made possible by this struggle." So you had to relive your times from your 20s up and up until now. But we have to talk about your four boys that are a result of the different path that you and Carter ended up taking.
And like realizing at a certain point that yes, we had a vocation to be parents, but not just that, but that we had hearts and temperaments that were ordered towards adoption. We had no hesitancy, both of us. We're completely on board, which is why we went ahead and jumped in our late 20s. Often people wait until they have exhausted, every fertility option. But we were what we really wanted above all else, as much as I wanted to. I had been a athlete in college. I ran a marathon. I played soccer. I played other intramural sports. And I was really looking forward to the physical challenge of pregnancy and birthing and all that stuff. I really was like, yeah, this is it. This is what I've been training for. And to not get to do that was, a disappointment. But really, at the end of the day, what I wanted more than anything was a baby. I just wanted a baby. And so real like I mean actually I can picture myself sitting in St. Matthew's Cathedral in Washington, D.C. On the left side, which is where we always sat. And we almost always sat behind a couple who had a baby and sort of watched her grow up for a couple of years. But I just sort of remember hearing, you're an adoptive parent. And I was like,
Really?
yeah, I am. And then we did. And, lucky for us, we didn't have to wait very long to welcome Orlando. And then it was funny taking him to mass and sitting behind that same couple, that little baby that we sat behind of all the time was now like two or three. And she was just like, you have a baby, you have a baby. And it was just sort of a nice little, unexpected celebration because obviously these were strangers. We didn't know them, but, the little girl rejoiced to see another little baby over there.
So, does the book offer tips for women and men, couples going through what you're going through, and you want to share just a little tiny bit with us? We don't want to give too much away.
Sure. It does. It talks about, I just talked about how we went to a mainstream doctor, and one of the tips is to kind of know your stuff, know church teaching, know what you are comfortable with. There are a couple things that are in some gray zones that no one has said explicitly yes or no about. Do your thing, examine your conscience, talk to who you need to talk to. Especially if, for whatever reason, you need to see a doctor who's not a Catholic doctor or a NAPRO doctor. And it's maybe just because you want the preliminary tests. You just want them done quickly. And you don't want to wait to get in line or, things. You get antsy. You've already waited 12, 6 months, 12 months, and no dice. So that's one of the tips, is to kind of know your stuff before you go in. But also be selective of who you go see for medical help. Other things are, about building a tribe of women. Somehow there's a real magnetism, like we infertiles we find each other, which is pretty amazing. And I had one friend in particular who I met a few years in to the struggle, but we already had Orlando. He was maybe no, not even one yet. And she and I both had been waiting to see Dr. Hilders in Nebraska. We both saw him within a couple of months. She and her husband also decided to pursue adoption while pursuing pregnancy. Neither of us ever birth the baby, but we both have four children. So should we say, not too shabby for a couple of infertile girls. We've got eight kids between us, and it was just the ups and downs, and to have someone, share that with you. I mean, I still remember before I went, I think she had had her surgery first with Dr. Hilders, and then as I was going, she brought me a little gift bag, and one of the things was a book of letters from Saint Gianna. And a sweet little note that she wrote on the tiniest stationery in a tiny little envelope and everything. And it's funny, those little details you remember. But we brought each other meals, we helped each other out when we had adoptions that were happening quickly. I think they put together like our co-sleeper for us while we were picking up the twins. I mean, just it's so, and I have many friends like that that you can still share with that. There's a shorthand in the vernacular of the infertile or the adoptive parent, or there's things that it's just easier to get to the point. And even if some of these people, maybe I won't talk to you for 6 months or see them, for years, and you can just jump right back in because we know, so I think building up that support system, finding some other people who might be struggling or who have struggled, or just understand your struggle. Sometimes, it could be an affinity of some other life-changing struggle, but I think somehow sharing that and picking up each other's cross, if need be, is a good life lesson.
Well, that is a great place for us to end, and we are really looking forward to your book coming out, and thank you for sharing such a personal story with all of us. And to learn more about Lee Sneed, check her out at our Substack, catholicassociation.substack.com, and make sure to buy her book coming out through Sophia Institute Press. Thanks for joining us, Lee.
Thanks, Betsy.